Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Twitch is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com. It's time for Twitch with Alan Malventano and Ryan Shroud, episode 57 for February 6th, 2010, the SSD Decoder Ring. I believe all systems are now go for a launch of This Week in Computer Hardware, episode 57 with, I just inhaled a carrot, Mr. Ryan Shroud. Hello, Ryan. How are you?
Doing pretty well. How are you?
I'm great. Ready to talk hardware.
You should try to chew those carrots up before you swallow them. That'll help.
Yeah. Who knew health food was so unhealthy?
With the breathing thing.
Yeah. Also joining us, our hard drive guru, the SSD king, Mr. Alan Malventano. Hello, Alan.
Hello, Leo. Greetings.
Greetings to you, sir. So you guys all recovered from CES now?
Huh. Yeah, yeah. I think we are. Alan got back from another trip just recently, and my travels continue as well. But CES hits you harder than most of the other ones.
Sure
of course.
Does. Yeah, Alan got a kind of a treat. We're going to get to that in a little bit. You got the inside scoop on Intel.
Yeah, it was some pretty good stuff.
Neat.
We'll cover that in a few minutes.
Let's start with NVIDIA and the ongoing battle, the GPU wars. Our embedded correspondent in the Direct Alex 11 field, Mr. Ryan Shroud.
Embedded is definitely one way to put it. Surrounded by product and requests for reviews and all that kind of stuff is another way. Yeah. But it definitely helps put things into the proper light, into the proper perspective. So one of the things we've talked about a lot on this show is DirectX 11 hardware, next generation graphics processors, GPUs from ATI and NVIDIA. And what we found is what happened was back in September, towards the end of September of 2009, AMD released their first set of DX11 capable graphics cards. The HD Radeon 5000 series is what started. So they released the 5870 at first, and then they did the 5870, 5850. And then they have continued to release newer revisions of graphics cards based on this architecture. So you've got the 5970, which is the dual GPU variant. I think even before the end of 2009, we saw the Radeon 5670 released as well. I think maybe that was in early January. But we saw a 58 series and 57 series and a 59 series card all released in the fourth quarter of 2009. Meanwhile, NVIDIA still, as of this recording in the first week of February 2010, has yet to release a DX11 capable product. And I think most people would have to say that they really haven't even released a competent DirectX 10.1 component either. So they are lagging behind ATI in terms of technology and features. DirectX 11 was a Microsoft creation, including features from it and that kind of thing. We talked about last week or the week before about some of the things that DirectX 11 brought, like tessellation and better support for direct compute, computing done on the GPU. So, if you guys are interested in that, check back the previous episode or two to hear our comments about what DX 11 actually brings. So NVIDIA has been behind, and now they're saying they're gonna probably have their first DX 11 parts in March. So that kind of gave ATI like a 6-month lead in terms of selling product with superior performance and superior technology and quote future proof options for the consumer. And I think a lot of people assumed, myself included, a lot of the other online media and people who deal with this stuff on kind of a daily or weekly basis, that would somehow translate into, better than average sales, taking back some, market share in the discrete graphics card world from NVIDIA. Because technically, I mean, a lot of what NVIDIA is selling is, 18-month, 24-month-old GPU technology that's been revisited and renamed and all that kind of stuff over the last, year or so. Well, we got a report from John Petty Research, which is a firm that a lot of people kind of in the hardware component and hardware, PC hardware industry depend on and count on, that had an interesting quote that while AMD had gained notebook integrated market share, they actually lost market share in the discrete desktop world through Q4 of 2009, which is very, in my opinion, counterintuitive to what we assumed would happen, that users would find the Radeon 5000 series with, you know, iFinity support and DX11 support and improved performance and better efficiency, you know, lower power consumption, that kind of stuff, that people would migrate to these in masses. But apparently that wasn't the case, because NVIDIA actually gained market share in the fourth quarter. I think one of the reasons for this was lack of availability. So I said the 5870 came out towards the end of September 2009, and there was a little bit of availability right when the cards launched. But through most of October and November, I would say getting a hold of these cards was fairly difficult. And most of that blame lies on TSMC, who is the chip foundry company that builds these Evergreen class GPUs for ATI. And they have had well-documented troubles, issues getting their 40 nanometer process technology up to the yields that they had thought they would be, that AMD and NVIDIA both hoped they would be able to get. And so there was a big shortage of these parts for the majority of the fourth quarter. And because of that, you know, AMD obviously didn't sell as many GPUs as they were hoping. And they didn't sell as many GPUs as I think a lot of online technical people like myself kind of assumed that they would. Obviously, this is great news for NVIDIA. If you're on that side of the table and you know, their marketing team puts on the best face possible, but they know they have the performance, they have a disadvantage in performance, they have a disadvantage in features and in cool new technologies like iFinity, multi-monitor gaming and that kind of stuff. But essentially what they did for the first half of their proposed deficit in time was weather the storm and actually gain a little bit of market share with their existing products. That means, so the debate is now, did AMD make the right decision in pushing ahead with their new technology? It obviously costs a lot of money to launch a new brand. They basically had to clean house on the 4000 series of cards. They pushed those out of the way relatively quickly and tried to move everybody into the 5000 series, you know, quicker than what you would normally expect the transition to be, at least from what NVIDIA's transitions have been. And so NVIDIA, on the other hand, whether or not it was by design or by chance, because they had some design issues of their own, was forced to wait. They were forced to wait this 6-month period before their new GPU was ready to be built on a 40 nanometer technology at TSMC and to be sold to the customer. It sounds like TSMC has kind of solved the issue now. Well, we have a lot better availability of these Radeon parts now in through the end of January and as we get into February. But what it looks like now is NVIDIA might have had, by luck, but like I said, by choice or by luck, the better option here, because they kept making the existing parts that were easy to make on the 55 nanometer tech. You know, they didn't have yield problems to worry about. They didn't have to risk the chance of losing money in order to fill the market with inventory. And they might turn out to be better for it in terms of actual market share. So that's kind of this story. It's more of a business-oriented tech story as opposed to a product-oriented tech story, because I think anybody that you talk to, except the most hardcore NVIDIA fans, will tell you that, you know, the Radeon 5000 series was an impressive product. It performed well. It had great features. It introduced a lot of cool new things. And usually when we see the first DX9 hardware or the first DX10 hardware that's available sells fairly dramatically more than the competition that comes in later, you know, 3 months, 4 months later. That may not be the case with NVIDIA's Fermi-based GF100 GPUs that will come out likely in March. We talked about those GPUs, I believe, last week or 2 weeks ago as well. So you can read, you know, listen to us talk more about what actually makes NVIDIA's GPUs different. But what's interesting here is that even with the advantage, AMD wasn't able to turn that into money and profit and market share or mindset. So it was definitely different than I think most of us expected. And I think, you know, a lot of people who listen to this show and guys like you, Leo, and Alan, well, Alan might pay a little more attention than Leo does when it comes to these types of things. But it's I would have kind of assumed that the technology and the performance would make the difference, when obviously the manufacturing and the manufacturing side of things came into play so dramatically here that it really adversely affected what AMD was able to do. That's good news for other companies like GlobalFoundries that are hoping to get GPU customers to come to them. If there has ever been a lead for that or a reason to believe that that would be the case, I think the disaster that was the 40 nanometer process at TSMC is kind of the poster child at this point.
I might for that. I call me crazy here, but maybe it's not the lack of supply, but just a lack of interest on the part of customers. Maybe the high-end graphics market is really gamers, right? And haven't gamers kind of, this is something that Paul Thurrott's been saying, moved a little bit more towards the console and away from the PC? Isn't this a dwindling market to begin with?
I would say, yeah, it's hard to deny that PC gaming has been on a downslide recently, but
maybe that's what you're seeing, you know?
It's possible, but I would still think that of those people that are remaining that are buying new graphics cards, I would have expected more of them to go with the ATI option than with the NVIDIA options available through Q4 of 2009.
But then that would come down to people just buying whatever the manufacturers put in there. Does NVIDIA have an advantage in OEM deals?
I would say in the integrated market, they definitely do. The discrete market, it's tougher to say. There probably aren't a huge percentage of desktop PCs sold at retail today that actually include a discrete graphics card. I don't have any numbers to back that up, but I would have to assume that if you go to your Best Buy or go to your Fry's or you order your basic system from Dell, almost all of them are still going to be using integrated graphics. And when we're talking about the discrete market and the fact that NVIDIA gained market share from AMD in the discrete market, you know, we're talking about anywhere from the $40 add-in card to the $400 add-in card. And what appears to be the case is that NVIDIA either had, you know, more push into those markets, into those companies that were selling these types of upgrades. And yeah, I mean, I think a part of it would be that NVIDIA has a better relationship with companies like Dell and that kind of thing going forward for those users that do ask for the integrated graphics. Apple in their iMacs, their high-end iMacs, and obviously in their Mac Pros, they were using mostly NVIDIA graphics cards as well. You know, all that kind of adds up. And I think most of us just assumed that with the better technology that would kind of switch over to ATI's 5000 series, and it obviously didn't happen that way.
Mm-hmm.
So, but no, I think
a short supply is really the problem.
I think it was short supply, and I do think there's something to the fact that PC gaming is I think it might be picking back up soon, but it over the last 6 months to a year, if not longer, it has been on a kind of a downward movement. And when you're on a downward movement, people aren't likely to upgrade as often.
Right.
And when they are willing to upgrade, they're less likely to buy a $200 graphics card than they are a $75 graphics card.
I'd love to see a study of kind of correlating numbers between people who are upgraders. I mean, that always seemed to be a small slice of the market.
Mm-hmm.
And PC gamers and just people wandering in and they just buy an HP Pavilion. and that's it.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah,
and there we go. We're done. I would bet you if you charted all these graphs, this would all make perfect sense. I mean, some of it's got to be short supply. There's people in the chat room saying, yeah, I keep going to the store looking for a 5870 or 5970, and they're not in stock. And I suppose that's some of it. But I have to think that it's also a general market trend here.
You think back and, like, you know, the downward spiral of PC gaming is a lot of people that are still playing PC games don't need the latest hardware to do it. So they're okay buying those cheaper cards, or alternatively, keeping the cheap cards that they have that came in their HP Pavilion systems,
right,
kind of like you're saying.
Right.
So if PC gaming increases in notoriety again. People start saying, look, all these cool things you can do on the PC that you can't do on the console. Oh, but you're going to need a new graphics card. It's going to cost you $150. We'll have to see what those people end up buying in 2010 type of deal as well. So,
yeah, I think this is the beginning of the end, to be honest with you, because it's surely the bad economy. It's surely, you know, right. There are a lot of factors, lack of supply. But ultimately, this is the trend is not your friend if you're in a high-end graphics card business at this point, I would think. I mean, these things have gotten expensive, and it's the market for them has gotten smaller and smaller.
Well, I would say they haven't gotten more expensive. I'd say they've actually gotten less expensive.
Okay, that's true. You get a good one for $200 now, huh?
Yeah, I mean, you can get really, really good graphics cards for under $200 now. What I'm hoping for when I'm kind of, you know, I think the entire industry is really gaming on is that these extra technologies that don't exist in the console world, like multi-monitor right. gaming, the angle gaming, 3D gaming, these types of things will bring people back to PCs in a way that we've seen the opposite of the dumbing down of PC gaming, where, you know, more developers were worried about what they were going to get on the console and that kind of stuff. And I still think that will largely be the case. You know, people are going to go where the money is, and right now the money is in consoles. But, you know, we're seeing things like we're doing a review of that first laptop computer that has an integrated 120 hertz 3D vision display on it. And there, you know, there's one option for a laptop that's $1,400, I think, or something like that. You know, so not super expensive. It's up there, but it's not, you know, like a $3,000 or $4,000 machine where it's offering something that consoles won't be able to. And I'm hoping that Eyefinity, DX11, 3D Vision, and NVIDIA Surround, with their iteration of Eyefinity, will help bring that back. Some belief that the PC can do more than what it could before. And also you get into the whole thing about whether or not social networking aspects break into this kind of stuff. What platform allows you to create these tools and integrate them more quickly than the PC? None of them. And if you want to do that kind of stuff on Xbox or the PlayStation, it's going to take a lot of time and system refreshes or software refreshes from Microsoft and Sony. Whereas on the PC, you know, you see the proliferation of Farmville, I know you're one of your banes, and things like Mafia Wars and that kind of stuff. Can we take that to the next level to make it 3D capable, more interactive, but it use those types of social interactions for it that you can't really do very well on a console? So
moving along, I like this. Next one is very interesting to me, and anybody who watched the iPad coverage might be interested in this. The Lilliput 7-inch mini USB monitor. Is this a monitor? What is this?
Yeah. It's literally just a monitor. It's 7 inches. It is an external display, connects to your computer through USB. We posted a review of it.
What do you need this for, though?
I think it has all kinds of potential uses. People who have one monitor probably find this hard to believe, but having a second or a third monitor is a huge benefit for what you can do in terms of productivity.
Yeah, but a second 7-inch monitor?
They have touch options. This one that we reviewed is not touch, but it's like $99, so it's relatively cheap. It's USB powered. You don't have to worry about.
I mean, it's really cute. I like it.
I think that some of the potential uses for something like this are obviously you have the photo frame and that kind of stuff, but it plays back video. You could use it as a monitor for video editing that you're using.
You could use it on a laptop, huh?
You could connect it to your laptop, and it's much more portable than bringing a 19-inch display with you as well. I imagine something like this sitting on my desk that's monitoring Twitter.
Oh, that's true. You can put TweetDeck in it and have it run.
You know, it's just extra real estate for some of those applications that, you know, don't need a lot of real estate, but they kind of get in the way. Your instant messaging, something like that.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Here's a perfect use.
Chat room.
You guys buy one for everybody you know, and you put a Twit logo on it, and there it's constantly running the stream of Twit.
Right. Yep. Now,
yes.
It's $100.
It's $100.
What can I get for $100 if I just run a regular monitor? Can I get a
larger display? You can probably get a 19-inch
okay
type display.
But you'd need another display support
Right. You would need to have the graphics card that can support multiple displays. Maybe you do, maybe you don't. If you've got integrated graphics, it's probably not going to support multiple outputs at this point.
So this really is for mostly for laptops. This would be really good for a laptop, I think.
You know, I mean, it's, you know, the review looks at, you know, using it as your Skype window. You know, you can play games on it. Obviously, you probably don't want to. But if you wanted to constantly monitor Farmville, you can do that. That kind of stuff.
Yes, it's for Farmville.
You know, everything.
I know I can find a use.
Everything finds a fallback to there. But I just think, you know, $99 doesn't. It's not a whole lot of money. It's kind of a neat little toy. Yes, you can get a bigger, more versatile monitor for probably, you know, $150 as well.
I'm thinking now I could use this on the desktop right here. Hook it up. You know, I have this 17-inch laptop, but I could use, like, just have Twit Live right here so I could see if we're on the air. That's kind of cool.
Yeah. Yeah. That's, I mean, don't go into this thinking you're going to have, you're adding a second display.
It doesn't have a speaker, does it have anything else? It's just a display.
It's just a display. And it's powered by USB. It's connected through USB.
Wow.
So it's extremely portable in that regard, right? You can take it with you, put it in your bag.
No power brick or anything.
You can take it with your laptop or anything like that.
Is it available now?
Yeah, oh yeah, yeah. This is something that's sold by ThinkGeek. It's been around for a while. If you go to their website, there's a link on the last page of the review over to their website where you can buy it. They actually have some touchscreen options as well. Obviously, they're going to run a little bit more, but they have I think they have a larger version as well as a smaller version. They have some that have different types of stands,
and you can run it on Windows. I mean, Macs, which is kind of surprising.
Oh yeah,
800x480. That's perfect for 480p video.
Yep. Yeah, exactly. I mean, that's you know, honestly, that's what I would purchase this type of thing for, is just to keep something that you want to monitor all the time, you know, but you obviously don't want to run your Excel sheets off of it and that kind of stuff if you have a choice. But it's just kind of a neat little toy for $99 to play around with and see what kind of uses you could find for it.
I'm buying one right now.
No iFinity required.
No iFinity.
We've got him spending money already.
Yeah, you took no time, did it, Alan?
Didn't even get to the sword stuff yet.
Wait, nice. But there's more? Oh, wait a minute. Oh, hold on. I'll save my pennies.
Save your cart, yeah.
There might be more here. This is good. No, I think that's... I can think of a use for it with a laptop particularly. Desktop, maybe not. Or, well, I guess if you don't have another port.
Yep.
Cool. 7 inches. It's 800x480. It's like a little iPad without any...
Obviously, it's not using much power, so because it's USB-based. So it does require two connections.
You've had it, right?
No, I have not had this. This is something one of our other reviewers tested and played with.
Did he think the picture was good?
Yeah. He said the image quality was good. Video playback, like he played back a 1080p video on it. Obviously, it was being scaled and had a little bit of a hiccup every once in a while. But with standard def 480p... no issues at all. So,
neato.
I would imagine wouldn't be a problem.
I could use it right now. Go ahead, Alan. If Alan says he wants to cycle his video, so we'll let him do that as we move on to Gulf Town.
Yes, this is some information that actually just kind of came out to us today. Intel had a press conference or a phone call, press meeting, whatever you want to call it, to talk about the different things that they're going to be discussing at the ISSCC, which stands for the International State Circuits Conference.
International, say that again? International Solid State Circuits Conference.
International Solid State Circuits Conference. Yes. It's difficult to say. That's why ISSCC still is a long acronym, but hey, it's easier than all that. This is something I know you have talked about several times on Mac Break Weekly, and we've talked about on Twitch.
This looks like the logical chipset, say, for a new Mac Pro.
Right.
Yeah.
So essentially what we got were more details on what Gulf Town was. We kind of knew some of this already. It's built on 32 nanometer technology. It's a 6-core processor, hyper-threading enabled, so it's 12 threads on a single CPU. It will have... a total of 12 megs of L3 cache on it. It will have Turbo Boost technology, so that whole auto overclocking power down when you don't need it, power up when you can use it, and you have thermal headroom and power headroom on your processor, that type of thing. It's a huge die, 240 millimeters squared, huge for a processor. GPUs tend to be a little bit bigger, but it is 1.17 billion transistors. We do have a picture of it in our news post as well. You can see how all the cores are laid out, the L3 cache, that kind of thing. Now, what's interesting here is the first 32 nanometer processor that we talked about a few weeks ago, that was the dual core Clarkdale and Arendelle. Clarkdale for the desktop, Arendelle for mobile applications, notebooks, and so forth. These were dual core hyper-threaded, so four total threads, but they integrated graphics on the CPU for the first time, not on die, but on package. So the chip, the processors actually had two chips on them. One dual core Westmere part that was a 32 nanometer, and then one 45 nanometer part that included the integrated memory controller and the integrated graphics. That's what our first look at 32 nanometer technology really was.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in this instance, we're talking about a six core, 12 thread, obviously super high performance part. We're not really interested in integrated graphics at this point. They have removed the integrated graphics. It's not included in this processor. But it does move the memory controller back on the die, and it does move it back from a dual channel to a triple channel design. So, you know, a lot of people expressed concern or had questions about the fact that we went from the first Nehalem architecture that was used the chipset for the memory controller, or I'm sorry, that used the chipset for integrated graphics. It had a triple channel memory controller, and then the newer ones, the Linfield that came out and then Clarkdale that came out, they had a dual channel memory controller and didn't use QPI, quick path interconnect, this really extremely high speed interconnect to talk to the chipset. They used a much slower one since it wasn't really necessary. Now that we're back to the more high-performance world, right? We're not talking about mainstream parts. We're talking about this is going to be an expensive, high-end consumer product. They're going to release server versions of it called Nehalem EP. You know, we're back to talking about running multiples of these processors on the same system. So, for instance, the Mac Pro that you guys, I think you guys have one of the new Mac Pros, right, that
we
came out.
Yeah, we have an i7, yeah.
These should be drop-in upgrades to those motherboards. Motherboards that have 13 LGA 1366 sockets. That was the initial release of Nehalem. Any consumer listening to this that has a Core i7-920 or anything like that, in theory, if your motherboard BIOS has been updated, which I think almost all of the major ones from ASUS, Gigabyte, and MSI have been updated, you'll be able to take out your quad-core part and drop in the six-core part, and it should all just work. You should be able to boot up into Windows. It'll see six cores, 12 threads. Boom. So that's a 50% performance increase and 50% cache increase, 50% core increase for, you know, well, not free. You're going to have to pay for it. But
no, it's the microcosm at work, though. That's the beauty of this. As things get smaller, the processes get smaller, the power goes up. It's kind of amazing, really.
Right. And actually, the power actually stays the same. The performance
goes up. Performance goes up is what I mean.
Power stays
Power consumption
same.
Goes down. Heat goes down. All of the negatives go down and the performance goes up.
Right. So you're able to get 50% more performance in the exact same thermal envelope, according to Intel, with the Gulftown processors. So that's good to know. They've integrated some additional power savings. They're apparently going to run with ultra-low voltage DDR3 memory that runs at 1.35 volts instead of 1.5 volts. So that will give some performance advantages as well. They also did confirm that there will be a 32 nanometer four core processor coming out relatively soon. And they didn't give us any more details than that. But same thing, you know, if they've got dual core 32 nanometer and six core, it only makes sense that they're going to have quad core. Not sure if it'll integrate graphics and that kind of stuff. My guess is that it will not. But yeah, and actually tonight on the podcast, and record that later in the evening on the PC Perspective podcast, we're going to go over a couple of other things that Intel talked about. Including more details on their 48 core. I think we talked about this several months ago. They used to call it the single chip cloud computer. Now they're calling it the 48 Intel architecture core message passing processor.
Of course, that's a much better name. Jeez,
not a very good name.
It rolls right off the tongue, Ryan.
So these are still research projects, but they're
This isn't a real chip.
Not yet. I mean, they have built them, and
it's
they're
a real chip, but not a product.
But they're not going to be selling it anytime soon. Yeah. So we'll talk about a couple different iterations of that. They also were showing off chip-to-chip interconnects that they got to run at 470 gigabits per second, which is really, really, really fast. And lots of other interesting things, research projects that they have going on that will all be demonstrated at next week's Integrated Solid State Circuits Conference.
ISSCC.
Yes. The other kind of newsworthy piece of information, not a whole lot to report here. NVIDIA did release that we talked about GF100 last week. And we talked about it a little bit today as well.
Right.
The official names for it are going to be the GeForce GTX 480 and the GeForce GTX 470. That's it. Nothing else about specs or performance or anything like that. They just kind of leak. It's not really called a leak if you post it to your company Twitter feed, I guess.
Yeah.
But yeah, so they're skipping the 300s. They've kind of destroyed the idea of using the 300s.
They should really call it the BGF 9000.
BFG.
No, Big GeForce 9000.
Oh, yeah.
That's the name I'd give it.
That would work too. They'd probably sell a lot more.
I should. Yes. I'm a marketing guy at heart.
Of course. Yes. Of course.
The ISSSCCCC BGF 9000.
All right. We do have some storage things to discuss as well.
Good thing we have the storage guy here.
Since we have Alan on board. The first one is actually, Alan and I talked about this a lot. I know we've talked about it with you, Leo. ASUS was offering an add-in card that supported two USB 3.0 ports and two SATA 6.0 gigabit per second ports on a x4 PCI Express card slot.
Yes, and I wanted this badly.
Well, now you can actually buy it.
Yay.
Well, I mean, I've been talking about it for months, it would seem.
As long as I still have the credit card out.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, and this one's cheap. You'll like it. This one is cheap.
How
30
much?
Bucks.
Really?
$30.
And it gives me SATA 3 and USB 3?
Yes, it does. Yes, it does. Jeez. I think Alan said this first to me. This is like the most selfless thing we've ever seen a company like ASUS do.
Yeah, because they could really cash in.
Right, but what the motherboard guys probably want to do is sell you an entire new motherboard,
right?
To get USB 3 and SATA 6G support. Here you can get it for $29. It's
Express Card 1,
right? Or no, it's PCI Express 2.
Two, yeah, it'd have to be because otherwise you wouldn't have that bandwidth.
Right. Now keep in mind, now if you look at the specifications on Newegg's site and on ASUS's site, it says it's compatible with, and it lists specific specific motherboards.
Yeah.
That's not the case.
No. Any PCI Express 2.
They have a list of motherboards they've tested it with, and of course they're all their own motherboards.
Right.
I have run this on a Gigabyte motherboard. I've run it on an MSI motherboard.
Sure, and it's a standard device, right?
I mean, it just works without a problem.
Does it need a device driver?
Yeah, you have to have drivers for it, but it's not an ASUS driver. It's an NEC driver for the USB 3 controller and a Marvell driver for the SATA 6 controller.
And what versions of Windows do you need to use?
You should be able to use any of them.
Really?
I'll have to double check and see if there's an XP driver. Alan, you might have looked that up before I had. I'd assume there's a Windows XP driver for it, but it's possible that it's only Windows Vista and Windows 7.
Alan? Oh, wait a minute, Alan. I have to push a button. Go ahead. Now you may
speak.
Oh,
you had me potted down.
I did. Okay. You know why? Because we were calling back and because we were trying to get this video.
No, yeah, it was. It has an XP and up. It supports XP and
up. Oh, that's great.
There you go.
That's great. You would think that to be the kind of thing that you'd have to have Windows 7 for USB 3 support or something, but I guess not.
No, nothing crazy like that.
Does it show up as a USB device and a SATA device?
Mm-hmm.
I guess
mm-hmm.
it would. All right.
Yeah. Yeah. Just standard
controller. It's basically the same thing as if they had integrated these chips on the motherboard.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Which is essentially the configuration that they use on this add-in card is identical to the configuration that ASUS uses on their higher-end motherboards today.
Got it.
They just basically took that, glued it onto an add-in card, and sold it to you for $29.
Neat. Boy, that's amazing.
Yeah.
And I've seen add-on Serial ATA 3, previous current generation cards where you just get a couple more ports, and those cards run for like upwards of $100.
Right.
So
they could have really gotten people on this. I'm impressed.
Right. Right. That's really good of them to
don't tell them though. Don't tell anybody. Newegg or ASUS.
Well, you know,
don't tell them.
Who's got to be happy on this is the hard drive manufacturers, and especially the SSD guys who make hard drives that really max out SATA 2,
right.
and USB
right.
2. And this is a real opportunity for them.
USB 3.0 accessory builders are going to be excited as well.
Well, are there a lot of those? I guess
we
cameras,
saw a ton
right?
at CES.
There's some good HD cameras, things like that.
A lot of external hard drives and that kind of stuff. Yeah.
Yep.
It's exciting.
Cool.
We are. The future is here.
So that's easy. Go buy those if you're interested.
Speaking of serial ATA 6, serial ATA 6 SSD right here, about to be tested.
Wow.
There you go.
Ta-da.
But that Vertex you talked about last week, that's certainly would benefit from serial ATA 6, right?
No, not that one. That one is old. No.
Oh, it doesn't have 6. Oh, even though it has incredible throughput.
It was saturating 3.
Yeah.
As fast as it would go, basically. But no, it wasn't.
So now I have probably confused people listening with my terminology. It's SATA third version 6 gigabytes.
And, yeah, 6 gigabits per second.
6 gigabits, I mean. So some people call it SATA 3.
Yeah.
Which is confusing. Some people call it SATA 6. Let's decide now. What do we want to call it? SATA 6?
Well, the thing that the standards guys keep pushing is for you to always call it by serial ATA 6 gigabits per second. That's what they prefer.
Because then it's clear we're talking about throughput, not revision number.
Correct. Talking about throughput. Now, what everybody would like to do is, you know, because initially it was serial ATA, and then serial ATA 2 is what everybody kept calling it, when really it was 3 gigabits per second.
Right.
Now you have the third generation. So
it was never officially as SATA 2. That was just what people called it.
Right. That's the name that really caught on first.
Okay.
And now that this new one came out,
now the confusion. Right.
Well, yeah, now we get the confusion. And what's funny is that nobody really talks about your data transfer rates in terms of gigabits anyway. You know, in reality, this new one is going to be around 500 megabytes per second, just like how the, you know, serial ATA 3 gigabit or serial ATA 2 gets you about 250 megabytes per second.
So to really confuse people, I'm going to call it SATA 500 megabytes. And then they're going to just
Alan
go.
Will call it something else, and I'll call it something else.
Yeah,
too.
Yeah.
Awesome.
I'll call it SATA 3. Ryan, you can call it SATA 6 gigabits. And Alan, you call it SATA 500 megabytes.
Oh, jeez.
Everybody will be confused.
Including me. I'm a storage guy.
Everybody will be confused. Anyway, that's all the same thing, which is the new SATA spec. And USB 3 is how fast?
USB 3, let's see. USB 2 was 480 megabit.
Right. So is it double that? No,
it's 10 times that.
10 times that.
No, it's 10 times that.
So it's 4.8 gigabits.
Yes.
Right.
Yes, man, amazing. Wow.
Right.
10X is nice. But you think about it, USB 2 has been around since the year 2000.
Yeah.
It's time for that upgrade.
Well, and also, everybody should know those are nominal speeds. Nothing ever hits nominal speed.
Sure.
Yeah.
All right, let's. Alan is going to impress us all with knowledge of his tour through an Intel and Micron. I guess who actually owns this fab facility that you got to walk around in?
It's actually the joint effort. Intel and Micron jointly run IMFT. That's why it's called IMFT, the Intel and Micron
Fabrication. Tough fun.
No, so this place is in Lehigh, Utah, and myself and a bunch of other storage reviewers, anybody that's been keeping any kind of tabs of tech news in the past week has seen all kinds of articles came out over the weekend talking about this. And it was a pretty cool tour, for sure.
I saw the Us Magazine review of it. It was just fantastic.
Was great.
People Magazine didn't really have the same kind of level of coverage, however.
Well, I got some pretty good pictures for my article. You know, I'm sort of a photographer on the side, and I like taking a good picture, and I managed to get some pretty sweet shots during this tour.
Did you get the bunny suit?
Yeah, I was the whole shebang. Wow. And I was a little bit used to that, though, since, remember, I used to work on reactor plants.
Oh, so okay.
You know, radiation suit, bunny suit. Yeah. Eh.
You say, same kind of thing. Where's my rad card?
Yeah, basically. Yeah. So definitely a cool tour. We got to see how these flash memory chips actually get produced, for basically sort of start to finish. I mean, there are some steps that take place, obviously, before, you know, these parts get to the fabrication facility. Basically, they start with a blank wafer, a blank 300 millimeter wafer, which is basically a foot across.
Wow.
So imagine, yeah, these things are pretty big now. Remember, the larger they can make these things, the more dies they can fit on one, right? It's more efficient because, you know, you can't really fit them at the edge. You have to go for what's at the center, you know, what's not catching an edge of the wafer. So basically, the idea is these wafers have to go through a bunch of different steps to make an actual chip onto them. And I included some links to some videos, embedded some YouTube vids into one of the pages of the article, actually, to kind of walk somebody through that if they wanted to get a feel for just what happens there. But to see it actually happen is pretty darn cool, because you see these wafers have to get transported to all different places in this facility. And I mean, they undergo hundreds of different steps. So a given wafer, even though it's, you know, it seems like it's not that big of a deal, and there's these little robot things that pick up, you know, with these little pods full of these wafers, and they transport them around, you know, sort of like designated driver, I guess, you know, rides the bus, yeah, goes over here, gets dropped off. But just the fact that they actually make like hundreds of stops to get from, you know, brand new wafer to, okay, this is the finished product. And even then, they don't even do like the final portion of the production of these things at that same place. I only saw basically the middle chunk. And then once they're done, those wafers leave, and then they get diced up, where they actually cut the dies off of the wafers. That happens elsewhere, and they actually package them inside the chips. So pretty cool stuff. Their actual announcement that they were making, and the whole reason that they brought all of us out there, was that they've made the next step down in process size. So just like earlier, we were talking 40 nanometers. You know, hey, there's these 40 nanometer processes that are being used, and that there's issues with production and all this other kinds of things that some fabrication facilities are having. Where I was walking through, these guys are making 25 nanometer process, and it was
Holy cow, that's amazing.
Yeah. And it was actually happening. So it's not like, you know, I mean, I can't say what the numbers were, but I was actually saw some computer screens talking about what their actual volume was, you know, how fast these chips are getting spit out of the fab. Those two pictures actually that you're looking at, pictures from the front page of the article that's on PCPer, I took both of those pictures. So that really close-up picture of a die,
that's amazing.
I actually took. That was just right off of that same wafer that was in the picture above it.
Wow.
So,
do you have a macro lens with you? That's incredible.
No, that was handheld with my Sony camera that I was using for the Vegas trip. That one you saw walking around.
Yeah, that cute little point and click. Yeah.
It's a DSC HX1 Sony. Nice, I love this thing.
Very nice, yeah.
So, yeah, I got to go, and actually I took that picture too, the panorama of the fab. I actually walked out of that place thinking, man, I would like to work here someday.
Yeah.
I mean, it was that cool. Just the area was all nice and everything. And
they got to get a nuclear power plant, though, to really make it something special for you.
This place came pretty darn close.
It's pretty cool looking. It, I mean, this really, seriously, this is true high tech. I mean, this is as high as you get.
Oh, yeah.
Right?
Yeah, this is as high as it goes. I mean, it's as far as I understand, it's going to be a while before any place else, including any other Intel fab, actually. They don't even have this rolling at any of their other fabs yet. This was the state of the art as far as just how small of a process you can make and mass produce as far as chip production goes.
This floor is perforated, you point out in your caption, so that there's a downdraft to push particles, dust and so forth, down into the floor.
Yep. Yep, and just walking around in there, I didn't have pictures of this, but just walking around there, they're always like, somebody's walking around with like a little Swiffer, like
all
a little
the time.
Special Swiffer thing. They're always like cleaning, they're always wiping stuff down.
No dust.
Even though there's people in, you know, dust bunny suits, all this other stuff, they are still very meticulous about keeping, you know, any kind of dust off of anything, anywhere within the fab. So, yeah, really, really cool stuff. Just to be able to walk. I mean, literally, everything in those pictures, I was walking right through
there.
I walked
neat.
Right between all that gear. So yeah, definitely cool to see how that.
A couple more pictures
helped.
Down there, you'll get to the good one.
Oh yeah.
Oh yeah. There's the good one. I tried to make off with one of the wafers. There's a picture.
those will shatter if you drop them. They're just like glass.
Oh, yeah. They were actually just trying to get that picture. They were like literally like scared. They're like, don't drop the wafers.
Well, how many wafers are on there? 2 terabytes of 25 millimeter flash. Jeez. And of course, if it gets dropped, it shatters. And it's
it would shatter. If I would have dropped that, it would have shattered.
Yeah. Wow.
Alan might not have come back from the trip then.
No. I'd be washing dishes in the back of the fab.
I wonder how much that one wafer is worth. How many chips do they get off a wafer?
Well, those particular wafers have just shy of 400 dies on them.
Okay.
And we're talking 8 gigabytes. In this case, that's what the big deal was.
8 gigabytes. Dies.
Not even bits anymore, but 8 gigabytes per die. And they actually stack up those dies inside the actual chip that you see, you know, on what's in your inside your solid state drive, for example. Nice. That actually contains a stack of those dies. It could be like 2, 4, 8.
Wow.
Something like that. So, yeah, pretty big deal as far as, you know, think about it. It's the same amount of material that gets used. There might be a couple of extra steps in the process, maybe a little more time put into it. But if you consider that the wafer is the same size and you're fitting, for roughly the same size die, you're fitting twice as much space now because of this new process, or twice as much storage space, I should say. That's a pretty big deal. And in the end, it's going to translate to, you know, cheaper flash memory. Simple as that. It's the next step in the chain. Just like how everything else gets smaller and gets cheaper over time, this is you know, that next step just for flash memory.
Well, so, you made a good point that we used to talk about NANDs in as bits. So you'd have a megabit memory or gigabit memory. Now we're talking gigabyte memories. 8 gigabyte dies. That's incredible.
Right, exactly. And
so high tech. It's so beautiful. I'm showing the Intel video, which is also in your article, on how they make these silicon wafers.
Right. Yeah. I found that. That was a pretty cool video up at the Intel.
Yeah, it's really neat. And then now they're doing the photoresist.
Yeah. It's photolithography. Basically, they put this chemical on there, and it only gels when it gets hit by a certain type of light. So then they do that, and then they rinse off all the extra.
Basically, etches the silicon.
Yeah. They do etching, and then they deposit extra material. That's actually a perfect shot of exactly how the process works.
It's incredible. It's just mind-boggling. We're working at 25 nanometers, 25 billionths of a meter here.
Right. And you're talking, like, for one of those channels is 25 nanometers. You're only talking about, like, 50, maybe 75 atoms across.
Incredible.
It's getting really,
it's sci-fi,
really small,
folks.
Here.
It really is sci-fi. Mm-hmm. And this is, they're lifting the die cool off stuff. Of the wafer.
And then all that they do.
There's the dip.
If you switch over to my shot, I'll show you something really cool that I did walk out of the fab with.
There's
something.
An 8 gigabyte dies there. No, 4.
There you go. It's two per slice.
Two per slice. Yeah. That's two 8 gigabyte.
This is
dies.
The entire die right there.
Wow,
that's like not much bigger than my finger.
That is neat. That is really neat. Wow, very cool. What a treat to get to do that.
Oh, it was great. It was definitely great. I'll be remembering that for a while.
Yeah, and it's so easy for us to take for granted. This technology that's all around us all the time.
No, I know. Every bit of it, every single one of us does that.
And this stuff is science fiction come to life. And I'm really glad you did this article because it really brings that home. You really can see it.
Yeah, you do take it for granted. These dyes are in everything. I mean, they're in your cell phone. They're in, you know, everything. Anytime you kick off your radio show and you talk about all that tech right at the beginning.
Yeah.
Hey, camcorders, cell phones, blah, blah, blah. All that stuff. All got this memory in there.
Yep.
Everything. Very cool. There's even some of it in your watch. I mean, you know, yeah.
And it's really what's transforming the world.
Yep.
Without a doubt. Cool. Speaking of transforming the world, Alan, you want to tell us about your SSD decoder?
I don't know if that's world shattering.
Well, it's important. Now, you did this before, so this is updated.
This is an update, and the update doubled the contents of the table to the point where we had to make it 2 tables because it was starting to break the website. So, yeah, we basically, you know, last update, or I should say the initial version that came out, we did it. It was in June or July somewhere back then. So about 6 months. And it was almost like faster than Moore's Law, if you think about
yeah.
it. All the
Holy
different models
cow.
Coming out.
So you sort by controller.
Right. And basically what I do on this SSD decoder table, which we actually have linked right off of the front page of the PC Per site. It's on the left side. There's an SSD decoder
PCPer.com, yeah.
Right. But what I do is I link to the controller type, and I basically segment them out by controller type, because you have a bunch of different manufacturers making drives with a particular controller, and on balance, most of them are roughly the same performance. I mean,
so the characteristic of the drive really is determined by the controller.
Absolutely, yeah. It really hinges on the controller type and the firmware in many cases, which is also another big deal, because now you have manufacturers releasing trim-enabled firmware for, you know, various drives.
Everybody's doing that?
Almost everybody. And to make that clear, I actually added a column on the right side of the decoder to specify if there was flat, you know, trim-enabled firmware available, and then I link right off that table to whatever that download page is for that particular firmware. So I'm trying to make it easy for some people. And
so
also
that's that column on the far right where it says no, 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 yes, yes, no, no, yes. That means trim-enabled.
Right, and there's even a couple of, you know how people will always tend to find a way. Sometimes people can't take no for an answer. So on the first page, there's actually a link for one of the, I think it's the Kingston, like there's a 40 gig Kingston drive that used an Intel controller, and Kingston didn't release a trim firmware for it, but somebody in the community, like hacking community, just took the Intel updater, and then they hacked it, and they made it work on the Kingston drive. So you just download this patcher, and you just update it, and then all of a sudden you get trim. Some people really want trim. So, and it's a good thing, too, because it boosts the performance of the drive. So, you know, that's why I thought it was significant to add it to that table. But, yeah, and some drives just are never going to get it. Like, so if I have a no that's in bold on that table for trim, it's never going to happen just because of, you know, either how the drive
get
was made
it.
Or...
Get over
you know.
It. Now, yeah, tell us again, I know anybody who's listening to this show knows exactly why we need trim, but just briefly, trim is an important feature in newer SSDs that solves, I guess, what is the equivalent of fragmentation on an SSD.
Right.
Stuff gets kind of mapped out, and the trim command, which is supported only in Windows 7 right now, resets the table and says, now you can use that.
Sort of. There are ways to add it to Windows XP and Windows Vista. It just has to be in the form of a piece of software that you run on occasion, sort of like how you schedule your defragment. There's tools where you can schedule them to run. And all those tools do is they go, okay, what part of the partition is not being used for actual files? They figure that out, and then they send the command to the drive so that the drive understands which areas are no longer needed or you know, empty space on the drive. So, and all it is really just a logistics thing. I mean, imagine you had a warehouse full of all these boxes, and this is the equivalent of an SSD trying to track all your chunks of data, right? Well, if the warehouse is only, you know, should only be 1/10 full because you only have the drive 1/10 full, you don't want all these empty boxes lying around everywhere else, right? Well, trim is the equivalent of, okay, make all those empty boxes go away. We don't need that stuff. So now when you have new stuff come in, new shipment comes in, whatever, now you have all this empty space. You can just stick it wherever you want. That's pretty much the equivalent.
That's a very apt, very good.
Oh, yeah.
So these tables are good for the do-it-yourselfer, but there are those who just want Alan to say, I'm one of them.
Which
the hell drive should I buy, Alan? And fortunately, the last page of the article satisfies people like that, whoever might be.
And it's still, what's funny is I haven't even updated that page yet, but I don't see a whole lot of a reason to update it yet.
Oh, interesting. So your picks are still good. Are you there, Alan? I think he froze.
Oh.
Or manufacturer, right? You know, as far as that kind of a recommendation, I'm still pretty bullish on the Intel drives. They continue to impress the heck out of me. There are some new drives like that SandForce one we were talking about.
Right, the Vertex.
That we reviewed, actually. That was very, very impressive. However, it's not out yet.
Right.
And when it is out, I don't believe it's going to really compete cost per gig wise. I think it's going to be a little more pricey, you know, as compared with the Intel drives, which you know, it's really just the reality of the situation, unfortunately. But hey, I'm all for the competition, and I'm definitely all for somebody coming out with something that performs better,
absolutely,
even if it costs a little more, right? Because that's going to make Intel sort of second guess their write speeds later on.
Yep.
And actually, I have it on pretty good authority that the third generation Intel drives are going to be very, very fast on writes. So just need to wait till towards the end of the year for those to actually come out. And they're going to be coming out with that 25 nanometer flash on them. So it's going to be pretty good stuff.
But just to reiterate, it's not. Don't wait. The time is. This is a good time to buy an SSD. It does make
absolutely
a huge difference if your computer can handle the speed. In other words, if it's a fairly sophisticated computer with a fast bus, if you're running Windows 7, trim might be something you'd look for.
Right. Pretty much any desktop system, even a few generations old, even a Core 2, even. I mean, dare I even go further back a little more? You're going to see a difference.
Yeah.
People
forget how I/O bound hardware is. We focus on all these gigahertz measurements.
Right.
But your drive is a very important part of your overall speed.
Right, right. And solid state makes a huge difference compared to regular storage.
I can't go
regular
back.
Regular spinning disk.
I'll be honest. I cannot go back. When I use a spinning disk as a boot drive, I just go, oof.
Oh, it's painful,
yep,
isn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, it's like what just happened to my computer, especially with the 40 gig models that come out.
Yeah.
You see them on like the Intel X25V, I think is the name of the model. It comes out for pretty low price, actually. Newegg had them for like $115 the other day. I think there was a 12-hour thing they did where they were less than $100.
Wow.
So you're talking, I mean, think about, it's at that price point, as long as you can deal with a 40 gigabyte drive as your C drive.
Which is actually a lot, folks.
Right.
You don't store your data on it. You don't store your temp files or your page files on it. But you store Windows on it and your apps. 40 gigs is a lot.
Right. You can, as long as you can make that shift and you're used to that, that is easily the single best, mm-hmm, performance per cost upgrade you're going to see. I mean, for $100, you're talking,
right,
any app you launch is going to be virtually instant. That's huge compared to a regular spinning disk. Simple as that.
The funny thing is this leads into our first Twitter question almost perfectly.
I do want to do a tease, though, because we're going to do our Twitter questions. But Dane's just came in the room and handed me a box from HTC. So I don't know what this is, but I thought at the end of the show we could open it up.
Absolutely. It's a Google one for me, I think. That's what they told me.
They said they'd send it to Leo?
Yeah.
I'm hoping it's the HD2 or something, but we'll see. We'll see what's in here.
It's somewhere on that box. It says forward to Alan. Yeah.
I didn't ask for it. I didn't solicit it. I have no idea how they even know where I am, but
it's a birthday cake or something.
And I'm going to open it up. It's going to be like, something silly.
A t-shirt.
But I just, I thought we'll save this for the end.
All right.
But meanwhile, you take Twitter questions. Tell people.
We did some Twitter questions.
Yeah.
If you are interested in submitting these for next week, you can follow me on Twitter. It's just twitter.com/RyanShrout. Pretty easy. And usually a couple hours before the show goes live, we'll start soliciting for some questions. You can send them anytime, but it's much more likely to get my attention if you get it there like a couple hours right before the show. But talking about SSDs and going back and forth and how your perception of these types of things changes. It was interesting. Our first question came from Mill Group, and he asks, why are my hard drives slow to spool up when I have Win 7 on an SSD? It's like they've powered down. And I asked him some questions about that, and he said, yeah, basically, he's got SSD as his primary drive. He has other hard drives that store all of his data, just like we're suggesting. And he said he noticed when he opens up Word and then tries to open a document off of that, there's a several second pause before the document opens. And
all right,
what's happening is, Alan, you can verify this for me, is like, if you're not using those drives, Windows will shut them down by default, will power the drives off. And when you access it, they do have to spin up.
And
that several second pause you get, they do it for power consumption reasons, right? And life of the drive and, that kind of thing. But when you aren't using them, they will power down. And if you want to access it, I see this all the time on my system as well, because I have the exact same configuration. One Intel drive is my boot drive, and then some standard hard drives for data storage. And there is, if you haven't used them and, you know, the majority of your day, there will be a several second pause before you turn it on, before you can access data on it.
Yeah, there's actually a few different stages to that with modern hard drives, because there are advanced power options if you go into like your power control panel on Windows 7 and then you you hit the properties for whatever that profile is that you happen to be using. You can set, there's a setting in there. Usually it's like 2 hours
or an
hour
or something. My hard drives to sleep or something like that.
For hard drives to spin down, that's an actual, it issues an actual standby command, a special command to the drive. Hey, I'm not going to use you for a while. Go ahead, do what you got to do. And then depending on the drive, they'll do various stages of sort of like a sleep or a standby kind of mode. Some drives will go as far as to actually spin down. If they spin all the way down, it'll take them anywhere from 10 to 15 seconds to spin back up and actually, pull data from the time that you ask them for it. However, a lot of most of the modern drives now have a ramp. It's actually like an exit ramp for the read head. Mm. So it actually pulls it off of the platter when it's not being used. And you don't want to constantly ride up and down this ramp, but the drives internally, their firmware will tell them, hey, I haven't touched anything for, the past 5 minutes or some amount of time, some short amount of time. And then in that case, they just park themselves. So, and it's at literally a park. Like with old hard drives, it used to be just go someplace where I'm not writing data. Now it actually takes the heads off of the platter.
So it just increases the time before they can move back and actually access the data that you want.
Right. The platter will still stay spun up, but it will take, 2-3 seconds. And you'll actually hear that some of the drives do this. You'll hear it, pull the heads back off of this little exit ramp thing to use it. But yeah, there's going to be some degree of that. And that whole, just the fact that you have your OS on the SSD, Windows 7 is always touching something for the drive.
Right.
It's always, it's always accessing something somewhere on the drive every couple of seconds. You can see that just by looking at your hard drive access light most of the time. So that's going to keep that drive active. Who cares if it's active? It's a solid state drive. It can, it's sipping on power anyway.
Right.
Let it run. But yeah, absolutely. Just let the drive spin down. It's, it'll just make them last longer. It'll make them less likely for something to happen. If it's an external USB drive and you bang on your table, well, you want the heads to not be on the disk anyway when that happens.
But that's really good information that you should go and set your SSD drive to be always on.
Well, you don't even have to. That's the default.
It won't really matter.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. All right. Not only that, but most like the Intel solid state drives drop to a fraction of their rated power within like a quarter of a second. It's almost instant because they can come out of it instantly.
Right.
They don't have to spin up. There's nothing for them to do.
Right. Got it. Yeah.
Yeah. So they can go to sleep as much as they want. I've never even had to touch that setting. Don't even bother unless you're really paranoid about. Oh my goodness, I want to open this Word document and I don't want it to take 10 seconds the first time. Then, okay, fine.
I agree with him. It does annoy me every once in a while because the perception is I'm just used to everything being accessed immediately on the SSD. When there's the slightest hiccup, I'm like,
come on.
I'm waiting.
I got stuff to do here.
Yeah.
All right. Our next question came from L. Hutchie said, can I swap the AMD 810 for the AMD 965 without changing the motherboard? And he has a Gigabyte MA770T UD3. And I asked our resident AMD expert, Josh, and he said, absolutely, you can do that. The motherboard, as long as the motherboard supports 140-watt processors, which he said this particular one did, then you should be able to upgrade from the AMD 810 to the Phenom X4 965, which is kind of their highest performing X4 Phenom processor. So that's apparently not an issue. That's one of the benefits of AMD's cross compatibility between processors and that kind of stuff that they've done significantly better job of than I think Intel has. And Intel had the history of changing sockets, would seem like every other month or something like that. Obviously, that's exaggeration, but it did that a lot more than AMD did. Through the AM2, AM2 Plus, and AMD or AM3 sockets. So with these, you won't have any compatibility issues there. And finally, our last Twitter question of the day came from Camster30. Do you know a gigahertz speed for the 6-core Intel yet, or will it be the same as 4-core but more torque like a bigger car engine? And he's referring, of course, to the Gulftown CPU we talked about earlier.
That's awesome. I love that.
It's a perfect analogy.
More torque!
it's a perfect analogy, right? It's your torque versus your RPM frequency.
It's
versus
a V6 instead of an inline 4 like the quad core.
Exactly.
The very first time I went to CES, I actually, AMD, this is when the Athlon was coming on huge, they had a, the very first event that I went to at CES was at a drag strip near Las Vegas, and they were comparing a Dodge Viper to a Corvette, and they were doing that exact comparison. Well, one of them is a V8, one of them is a V10, but the V8 runs at a higher clock speed than the V10, so which one's actually going to get you to the end goal faster, right? And they were comparing Intel to AMD processors in that regard. So the analogy fits well.
I'd like to put a Flowmaster on mine.
Spin that baby up.
Yeah!
Get some extra horsepower. I don't know what clock speeds Gulftown will run at yet. I would say it will be close to the top frequency of the 4-core parts that exist today. Because we are moving from 45 nanometer to 32 nanometer, they should have a little bit additional headroom in terms of power consumption. I would say they might match. So it might be 3.2, 3.33 gigahertz clock speed, but it also wouldn't surprise me if it's a little bit lower as well, just because of we're getting 6 cores instead of 4. So 50% increase in the amount of transistors and performance on there. I don't actually know the answer yet, but I don't think we're gonna have to wait very long to find out. I think they're pushing this Gulftown launch along relatively quickly. I'm getting a lot of inquiries from motherboard manufacturers asking if we can use their board in our review, et cetera, et cetera.
That's a good sign.
I imagine the CPUs will be arriving very soon, and then once that happens, I won't be able to tell you about it. So
so as long as you're talking about it, you know nothing.
Right.
And as soon as he knows anything, he has to shut up.
Yeah, that's what happens sometimes.
That's why I don't do NDAs.
This is the show of we can tell you, but we got to kill you.
Yeah, right. Can I open my box?
Yes, yes, yes. And while you're doing that, I'm going to tell you, you personally, Leo,
will
want to tune in for next week's show.
I am going to tune in. I'll be here. How could I not tune in? Why? What's next week?
Next week, we'll have... I think I should have it up by then. Yeah, a write-up of a very, very, very cool notebook technology from NVIDIA that they've been teasing a lot called Optimus. And I think it's something
Optimus
that you will
Prime?
Be interested
in.
It's not Optimus Prime. They would probably get sued for that. But the name of it is Optimus. It's very, very cool mobility graphics technology that I think you'll be interested in.
So, as you know, I'm using the Google Nexus 1 as my current full-time phone, and still no regrets. Love it. It is so great. In fact, Google's pushing out a multi-touch update for it over the next couple of days.
I saw that.
Yeah, mine hasn't come yet, but they're going to update all their apps to do multi-touch. Then that was really the only thing that made this phone a little bit less than the iPhone. So, I'm thrilled. Now, it's an HTC handset. In fact, some say it's really the HTC HD2, right? That's what everybody's saying. It's like the HD2. I don't know why, but for some reason, I've got a box here from HTC. Didn't request it, didn't ask for it. Maybe they noticed that I like the Nexus 1. Should I open it?
Might just be another Nexus 1.
It could be, I don't know, it could be Dick D. Bartolo's head in a box. I don't know what it is. It could be anything. It could be just another Nexus 1. It could be. In fact, ladies and gentlemen, it is... not another Nexus 1, but it is. It says Nexus 1. Now I know what it is, and I did, in fact, ask for this. It's the Google. I didn't ask for it. I bought
the dock.
$49 I paid for this desktop dock. And
that came to you straight from HTC?
Isn't that odd? It didn't come from Google. No one. That's why it fooled me. So
I'm just surprised it came from HTC, like, directly. That's
pretty
crazy.
Yeah, isn't that wild? So I had a dock for the Droid, and I really loved it. You'd plug in the Droid into the dock, and it would go into its clock mode, which all Google phones have. Let me hide my pattern. Not that you're going to be in the studio anytime soon to steal my stuff, but
no, I will be.
Yeah, we know you will be.
We're coming.
We know you will be. But the clock mode, if I go into it, it's just it's the clock application, and it's a kind of a nice mode. And when you go into a portrait, What are you laughing at? When you go into portrait, it does a nice portrait thing, and you can do a slideshow, and it shows weather and stuff. And so the idea is you would sit it on your in the Droid. You do that. You sit it on your desk, and it becomes like your Droid clock. But there's a problem that I thought might be a problem on the Nexus One, which is that unlike the Droid, which has its connector there for the landscape mode, the Nexus One has its port there. So I guess the dock is going to have to be. And this isn't going to be very good if it is, but. I still like it. I like the idea of having something to put my phone in when I plug it in. Oh, it is. It's a dock like this. So let me plug the dock in.
It was just like Murphy's Law of presentation there. The thing will always not switch when it's supposed to.
Because it doesn't believe in it, right? It says, no, I'm a Nexus One. I don't go that way. Oh, wait a minute. Oh, that's interesting. It just has regular little connectors on there.
Uh-huh.
So it doesn't have, actually, it doesn't go into, that's weird. Maybe I need something else. It's got a power thing here, too. Well, it's not doing what the other one did, but maybe that's because I have it locked. Let's see. Use dock for audio, music, ringer, alarms. I remember saying, okay. So now it's in the dock mode. Anyway, there you go. That was all it was. I got all excited. I thought it was an HD2. Boring. Aww. Boring. It's just a dock. So I should have really, said, I'll do this tomorrow. Let's do a live show. We'll get all the people watching. It does have, this is interesting, it has an audio connector as it comes with. So I guess I could plug it into speakers. Oh,
that's pretty cool.
Because this has a lot of music and podcasts and stuff on it.
Well, the HTC handsets all use that special mini USB connector where the pins are actually on both sides. So it passes audio out of that connector.
Oh, I didn't know that. I really like the mini, or is it micro USB? I really like it.
That one's probably just mini.
Okay.
I think all the HTC just settled on that mini thing. You can even get there's a little adapter thing you can get that has a headphone jack on it. And a USB connector on it, and then you plug it into that port at the bottom, and since all that stuff is in the connector.
Very cool.
Yeah. Well, there you go. There you have it. That's what that was. Nothing exciting, nothing new, nothing different. Something, in fact, that I actually purchased and just forgot about.
But now I can just... But what's nice is it just sits there. It doesn't have to go in because it's got contacts there that hit the contacts.
Leo, I can see how you would forget about what you purchased, Leo.
Yeah. In fact, one of these days I'm going to get a 7-inch screen I forgot I bought. Well, what's this from Think Geek, everybody? Oh, boy, excited. Oh. Never mind.
I bought that.
Never mind. Sorry. I bought that. And I think that they told me that they are coming out with a car connector. Maybe they already have it out as well. That's another thing the Droid has for the GPS. It turns it into a GPS device.
Right.
Okay. Right. Okay. So thank you, gentlemen, for This Week in Computer Hardware. Stay tuned, everybody. PC Perspective is coming up in a couple of hours with the same cast of nuts. And Colleen will join you and whoever else is on the show tonight at 7 p.m. Pacific, 10 p.m. Eastern, right here at live.twit.tv. Ryan Shroud is at pcper.com. You can follow him on Twitter, at Ryan Shroud. Ask him questions, too.
Yes.
For next week's show. And you can also email him at ryan@twit.tv. Alan Malventano is busy keeping our nation safe and our nuclear reactors from melting down for the United States Navy. And you can see his work, too, at pcper.com. Thank you, gentlemen.
Hey, I'm at all those same links that you got for Ryan, actually. I think we got them all set up, right? I'm at Malventano at Twitter, and I think I've got Malventano at twit.tv.
Is it Malventano or Al or Alan? I'm not sure.
No, I think it's...
Is it Malventano? Okay.
I'll find out.
Okay.
We'll find out.
I could go online and find out.
Nah.
That's too much trouble. Too much trouble. I want to play with my dog. All right, everybody. Thank you for joining us. We'll see you next week.
This Week in Computer Hardware.